Everything that there is to be loathed about John Lovell's book, The Warrior Poet Way, can be found on the inside cover. He starts with, "There is a war on masculinity, and everywhere we look, on every front we sacred, we can see the painful reminders of a collapsing order. The chaos and crisis we are experiencing today should be a signal for men everywhere to rise up, to fight, to preserve our way of life by once again walking the ancient paths. But this isn't a journey that need be taken alone." Now, this is a review, a public review now, of the Warrior Poet Way by one John Lovell, or in case you wanted a note that I have read or listened to the book, Lovell. There's a joke in there if you've read the chapters. And this review is going to come in two parts. Now, it's all going to be contained in this video or this podcast, but the first half is going to be spoiler-free and overall assessment and suggestion, and the second half is going to be spoiler-heavy with going chapter by chapter, talking about some of the theses and highs and lows and value arguments that he makes within the book. So let us, without further ado, begin. John Lovell's book, The Warrior Poet Way, comes from a long lineage of books written by men to Christians, or written by Christian men to Christians. Now, this one was published in 2023, but one of the books that could be said came before it was John Eldredge's Wild at Heart, which was published in 2001. And before that, there was Point Man by Steve Farrar in 1990. And before that, there was The Man of Steel and Velvet by Andelin in 1972. And you could even go back to 1899, where James Isaac Vance writes the book called Royal Manhood. And this lineage brings out, in a sense, the initial value of the book. Just because not everything that is said in this book is novel or original or completely produced by John himself alone doesn't mean that it doesn't have value. Now, this is far from an argument saying that there's plagiarism to be found in there. By no means. He is even calling back to this idea of an ancient order in the inside tab. And so the value, the introduction, the book itself is one more example of a good book written in a string of good books of earnest, honest men writing to their earnest, honest audience. However, The Warrior Poet Way differs from authors like C.S. Lewis and Mere Christianity in that it is not explicitly and entirely arguing from a Christian worldview, but implicitly at times and explicitly at others. Be clear, it is not that you find the entirety, the thesis of the book to be explicit and entire from the beginning, an argument for a Christian worldview. Rather, that sometimes John argues implicitly, and sometimes he argues explicitly. And it does not begin with an argument for a Christian worldview like C.S. Lewis does in Mere Christianity, but rather, he doesn't follow the same format of Mere Christianity by C.S. Lewis by beginning with an argument for the Christian worldview and then fleshing it out in additional chapters. But rather, John begins with a combination of moral urgency and moral imperative that are both justified not only through a Christian worldview, but in a sense resolved. There is an imperative, but that imperative also where the imperative serves as a solution to the urgency of sorts. The imperative, I need to explain that one more time because of how I'm trying to be specific about this. In Mere Christianity, C.S. Lewis begins with an argument for the Christian worldview and then explains it in further chapters. John does the opposite. He begins with a moral imperative and a sense of urgency and later argues that that very moral imperative is a solution to the urgency introduced at the beginning. And that is similar to that is why I put it more genealogy of Wild at Heart, Point Man, Royal Manhood, The Man of Steel and Velvet. Now, as for the tone, if you've watched John speak, whether on YouTube or in person, he maintains the same John Lovell attitude, the same John Lovell presence. He is serious at times and then silly. He will explain something that is deep and painful and then wrap it up with a dad joke. This tone remains consistent in his book. So it is unmistakably written by John Lovell. I don't think there's a ghostwriter going on here. Sometimes it comes to good effect. But if you But John is not writing from the position of a father or a mentor or a sage. He's rather writing somewhat in the style of a youth pastor who is simultaneously encouraging and provoking thought with a small window of exposition. And so this is not a, you know, John Lovell's book, The Warrior Poet Way, is not a commentary or thesis level, like, not thesis even, it's not a commentary or dissertation level argument. It's much more of a digestible and, in fact, quite encouraging book, and I don't think that does it disservice. Of course, my opinion about the book is going to come through. So the tone is classic John Lovell. Serious, then silly, then serious, then silly. Now you get something that I did not expect, and I caught on a second pass-through, was the amount of foreshadowing that John introduces in the beginning. And the foreshadowing, this is without doing the spoiler thing, he hints at the theses of one of his chapters in a subtle way in the introduction, and he rewards the reader with a second pass-through going, oh, I know where you're going here now. That makes it so much better. And so one of the things, if you're going to rate this book in the same way you might rate a video game with rereadability or replayability, there's a decent amount of it. It might be a book that you could read every other year quickly through, even if you just did it through Audible, and you might be better off. But let's start with the overall thesis of the book. In my words, the overall thesis of the book is this. It is a Christian whole man argument. John is making a Christian whole man argument that there is not only no contradiction between a man being capable of both extreme violence and fierce love, but that it is desirable, and even more than just desirable, it is a moral imperative for each individual man to strive and pursue. Let me say that a second time. A Christian whole man argument that it is not only no contradiction between a man being capable of both extreme violence and fierce love, but that it is desirable, if not a moral imperative, for each individual man to strive to pursue this ideal. It differs from the Aristotelian whole man in that John acknowledges that each facet of the whole man is understood as a reflection of the identity of Christ. So it is a Christian book. If you're expecting to get some sort of agnostic or atheistic solution to international problems, I don't really know why you're reading this book, but if you are, congratulations. Now let's address one negative component about the book, or a couple of the things that I think detract from it entirely. John starts the book with war imagery to create a sense of urgency. I believe that John is authentic in his feeling of urgency. However, John has gone to war. He knows what war is, and he knows what he is talking about, and he knows what he is talking about is not war. Let me be clear. The opening, the inside of the book, starts with, there is a war on masculinity, and everywhere we look and on every front we hold sacred, we can see the painful reminders of a collapsing order. John uses that, and I think he believes that there is a conflict, but I think he misdiagnoses it as a war, because if he were, as a man who has been to war, who has seen violence, fully invest in the moral framework of a war, he would find better ways, or he would include in his book an argument and justification for going to war, justifying targets and being not just defensive or productive inside the home. He would assert something outside of the home. And I'll expand on this. John starts with war imagery. However, he has gone to war, and what he is talking about is not war. And I'm not even talking about the physicality of civil war. Rather, warfare does not take place in the home. It takes place in the culture, in society, in your churches, in your businesses, in your government. If your home is collapsing, you are not going to war. The war is not in your home. Soldiers who go to war have to deal with something different when they are in their home. And if they treat their wife and their spouse and their kids like their privates, their battles, their missions, then they are going to compromise their life at home. And much of this book argues for the life inside the mind and inside the home, whereas if he is talking about a war against masculinity, he should be imploring men to go into the businesses, go into the culture, go into your church, participate in your local government, participate in your community, and find, fix, and eliminate those who are attacking what is right and true and good. Instead, he talks about building character and developing oneself into the whole man, which is a wonderful thing to argue, but it is different warfare. If he is referring to spiritual warfare, he falls into the same trap as many other authors and should be acknowledged for that, not as a dig, but that this is a big issue and that it is too vague. If he is talking about spiritual warfare, John is too vague. But that is not exclusive to John, and it is not a ding on his character. It is more a identification of the gravity of that kind of conversation. Now, as for some the things that are really good about the book, there are entire chapters that caught me completely off guard. And I have known John, and I have listened to John Lovell's material for many years now. I've had some conversations with him. I can't call him a friend because we're not close like that, but at best an acquaintance. And John, in places where I was hoping to find exposition, John opts or chooses to go with exhortation, and those places caught me off guard in the best of ways. When he later gets into the difference between goodness and greatness, he shines in his writing, which is about as far as I can go without spoilers. And so in the pre-spoiler section of this review, I should wrap it up as best as I can. Who is this book for? Men, mostly men, at all reading levels, leading towards the beginning to intermediate level of reading. So if this isn't your introduction into this type of literature, if this is your introduction into masculinity, or if you've read Donovan, The Way of Men, or even Why Young Men by Jamil Giovanni, or if you've read a little bit of 12 Rules for Life by Jordan Peterson, this is a book that kind of fits in that genre. It's definitely beginning to intermediate level. It's definitely a book that you don't read it and get tired from reading. It doesn't wear you out with the rigorous depth and the rigorous detail that you would expect to find in somebody like Charles Taylor. It's not so dense that you need a dictionary to get through, but it does leave the reader better off than when they started. And I think it's one of those books that I've been critical of in the past, and I've been critical of Wild at Heart and Point Man and Of Steel and Velvet, but it fits within that genre, and for me as a person, it redeemed that genre with a new, not necessarily coat of paint, but a new book is probably the best phrase, that encouraged me to reconsider how I evaluated that lineage of writing. And so... the overall spoiler-free summary of The Warrior Poet Way is that it is a book to have on your shelf. It is not the gospel. It will not change your life like the gospel, but it will open doors and it'll ease open those wounds that need healing. And I think this is a good book for that. So I'm going to stop for a moment. And then I'm going to stop, and then let's get into the spoilers. All right, so I've given you ample time to click away if you have not read the book, and if you want to read it without spoilers, but let's get into it. So this is the spoiler half of a review of The Warrior Poet Way by John Lovell. And I'm going to start a little bit in the introduction, but then I'm going to go chapter by chapter, addressing not only each chapter and some of the theses in them, but admonition or criticism. Well, is that the same thing, admonition? It doesn't matter. Some of the arguments that are inside it from my own position, and to address it as rigorously as possible. Now, the introduction of the book comes with a wonderful amount of foreshadowing, but that's what an introduction is supposed to do. And what I mean by foreshadowing is John is preparing the reader for what he's about to write about. Now, I want to focus more on the good things of the book, particularly because I think that is what is most important on what to be taken away from it. And I think about that in the sense of how are we building one another up? I can be a critic just like any other critic who can say mean things about somebody else's book, but I haven't one to replace it with. And I think encouraging and in speaking to the qualities of this book are going to be the best way forward. That being said, there will be some criticism. So let's start with the introduction. John introduces a series of assertions in his introduction, and one of them can be in the early part of the introduction where he says, men were meant for more. Now, these phrases might oftentimes come as a little bit inspirational, not quite on the live, laugh, love level, but on a level where they're kind of asserted without qualification. They're asserted without describing them in a metaphysical system. And another example of that is in this sentence. If the dormant parts of you and me came fully awake, imagine the lives that would benefit, those of our wives and our children, as well as our coworkers and community members, even our friends. So this is it's an argument that paints the world without explanation that you have potential and that there is potential for you to be more, which we sort of inherently know, but we aren't justifying in a full metaphysical explanation. But if we get into chapter one, and that's what is included in some of the introduction. As you don't read the introduction as a rigorous philosopher who's trying to parse and particulate each element into its most distilled form. Recognize that John is writing more in his classic way, where he is not only trying to inspire and encourage, but acknowledge in himself ideals that he could pursue better. And so let's get on with ideals. Chapter one is a world in need of warriors. Now, this is indicative of both John Lovell's style of writing. You see, in the beginning, he opens up with this sort of war scene, which turns out to be a stick fight between friends. And again, this is that John building urgency and releasing it with levity, sometimes in catharsis, sometimes in sort of stagnation. But he talks about, and there's an important element that needs to be addressed on page four. He makes the statement, there was a time not too long ago when men were allowed to be strong. And this is where the tone and phrase of John's writing is indicative of that lineage that I've talked about in the past, but I want to start to take apart. What he is arguing is that the world that you exist in is one where you must seek the permission of others to do the thing that you ought to do. There was a time, I'm rereading again, there was a time not too long ago when men were allowed to be strong. A strong man is not strong because he's allowed to be. A strong man is strong. It has nothing to do with being allowed. If you believe there is a moral imperative to be strong, then it is regardless of the permission of other people. What is more important here is he goes on to talk about on the next page about we must summon the part of us that our society hasn't completely squashed with the hammer of political correctness. The concern that I have in this framework will be resolved a little bit later, but it does come up like this. If you believe that you need the permission of somebody who wields political correctness as a hammer in order to be a man, you will always lose. Do not ask for permission from people who despise the thing you're asking permission to be. If somebody overtly states that they hate that which is good, do not pursue that person's permission to do what is good. If he makes a moral argument that men should be strong, should be courageous, should be in control of themselves, but yet he argues that you must also seek permission for it, it dismisses the qualities that he's arguing for. But as we move on, this permission seeking is not unusual, but instead he goes on page 23 and he brings up the ideal. This is our ideal, quoting page 23. A man who is dangerous enough to kill and just might, but who is never out of control. A sacrificial savage. A man who such a man loves well and fights well, able to discern what is needed. And this is the thesis that makes John Lovell's writing so good. This is the value that he's arguing with. Instead of leaning into painting the world as this weird battlefield where you have to do permission seeking with people who hate you, why don't you lean heavier into the ideal and argue that it is simply good for men to be dangerous and be in control of that danger? Now, he does that. And he does that in the first chapter, but he does that at the second part of the first chapter. He doesn't do that in the beginning. And this is that tone, that sort of style of writing that I personally don't enjoy, which is present urgency, present solution. Turns out the solution and the urgency aren't really connected, because the urgency is that men are not men anymore, but you can be a man, which is sort of the solution, but not really, because just do it. It doesn't stick the weight that it could, but he, more importantly, addresses the ideal of the whole man, and he does it successfully. John presents a Christian ethic argument. Well, he presents a Christian whole man argument that men should be both capable and in control, that people should not look at them as soft and dainty, but rather dangerous and moral at the same time. Good job. Excellent with the ideal. The second chapter is titled The Most Dangerous Man in the Room. And in this is basically a mindset chapter. And in here, you get the advice that a seasoned fighter is giving to younger men. The idea that the most dangerous man in the room is not going to be a novel idea for some readers. If you've been to war, perhaps for a while, or if you've been experienced in jiu-jitsu and you've gone to go down fighting sports or fighting, you know, fighting skills, I guess, this chapter is entirely going to be novel, but it is of vital importance. And that is, John is, once again, as an experienced or seasoned fighter, giving advice on mindset to younger men. And that advice and that mindset comes up that the advice is that the way that we evaluate people's skill and danger should not be as skin deep as it is presented. In fact, the people who participate in the most dangerous activities very rarely telegraph it or show off what they're doing. Now, this idea could be fleshed out a little bit deeper, and it is presented in a rather safe and harmless manner. John is presenting the idea of a dangerous man in sort of a very gentle delivery. And perhaps that's the point, because John might actually be laying a trap for other men's ego. By presenting, if you were to think of John as a predator, he's going to write a chapter about being the most dangerous man in the room without presenting himself as the most dangerous man in the room. But then he also is using that as an opportunity to give advice to younger men, especially those who are going to be engaged in professional violence, that the pathway or the people who are the most dangerous do not make it very obvious at all times. In fact, we might be better off not to. There's an added imperative, however, buried in this chapter, in that he is also arguing. He also adds a combination of something like the Strassow generational theory, which is, hard times create good men. Good men create easy times. Easy times create weak men. Weak men create hard times, or whatever that four-way rotation is. He takes a combination of that and this sort of assertion that there will be dangerous men, but will they be good, into effect? And he argues through those two things that it is there's a bit of a moral imperative for good men to also be dangerous. And so, in the beginning of this chapter, I appreciate that he presents it in this way, where he begins with explaining as a seasoned warfighter or a seasoned fighter what dangerous can look like, or how being truly dangerous doesn't present itself so obviously. It doesn't boast about it. I appreciate that he starts with that, but then he ends with a bit of a moral imperative that men who are in pursuit of the good ought also become dangerous. Now for chapter 3, which is Battle the Inner Coward. Let's see, do I have all my notes on this one? Very important identification of strong, bad, weak, and good. Oh, let's stick back with, let's go back to chapter 2, The Most Dangerous Man in the Room. On page 43, a man is not dangerous because he is strong, but quite the opposite. In his greed and cowardice, the wimp will betray another and not even know it. Because he of his weak disposition, he will hurt others accidentally, clumsily wrecking everything around him without much awareness of the consequences at all. Now, John is, this is something that I think that he, I'm so glad that he introduced, because this is again on the level of The Most Dangerous Man in the Room, on the chapter of The Most Dangerous Man in the Room. He starts to illustrate how the opposite of strength can oftentimes be more dangerous. Now, he doesn't use like the dull knife metaphor, but he talks about how not only is strength something that men may have, but they ought have, because being weak is actually detrimental and dangerous to your family, because you may not be able to, say, climb the mountain or run the 5 mile in the time limit or bench press what you need to, but because that weakness will manifest in malice towards those around you. And and while it's written in John Lovell's way, that is something, that is a point that so oftentimes gets missed in the conversation about strength, that weakness is actually dangerous in that manifests in malice towards other people. So let's move on to chapter 3, which is Battle the Inner Coward. And he starts with a quote by William Shakespeare, "Cowards die many times," Shakespeare, "cowards die many times before their deaths, the valiant taste of death but once." Now, this is one of those chapters that I think can be cut away from the book, not to remove it from the book, it should stay here, but be read when you're reread multiple times when you're about to face a dangerous or something that scares you. The opening is a little bit lighthearted for my tastes, but it still is relatable. And he talks of cowardice in multiple different ways, and he also talks about becoming brave. This chapter on battling the inner coward will be paralleled in a later chapter, but I get the impression that this chapter could become a book in itself, and it, as a chapter, reflects a lot of the overalling spirit of the book of the whole as a whole. If John was, I would not be surprised if John started with this, the writing on Battle the Inner Coward, and later turned it into the whole book. So I'm going to move past that, because we need to get into chapter, or the next chapter, which is 4, which is Face Death or You Die. This is a touching chapter full of lamentation and indicative of the turn from young man to midlife, but with gravitas. This identifies some of where John is, and it's a chapter that oftentimes gets missed in the sort of self-help books, where the self-help books will either try to like our chest beat into bravery, or in some ways skip this section altogether, because there is a sense of dread and sorrow and suffering in this chapter that is completed by facing your death before you die. And I don't want to spoil the weight of the chapter, but I'm going to use only a couple quotes to expand on it. And then, I mean, I guess this is the spoiler-free, or this is the spoilered section. But we go to page 86. And there's a paragraph that reminds me quite a bit of what you see in the movie Night and Day with Cameron Diaz and Tom Cruise, but you also see this one here. "Telling yourself that you'll start living the way you know you should, but after this," I added the "but," "after this." And the whatever the "this" is, the next thing could be a raise. This is a continuing reading. "The next thing could be a raise, some stressful situation at home, or even a big goal. Then you tell yourself you'll spend more time with the kids and wife and focus on reconnecting with those you care most about." The other way of saying that, though, is telling yourself that you start living the way that you know you should after this. After this what? After this hit? After this drink? After this bender? after this weekend, after this time alone, after this failed relationship. I think there's John in the chapter on facing your death before you die, John writes an immensely practical chapter on telling yourself I'm not living for tomorrow. It's not living for another day, but rather changing the way that you look at the world in a very practical sense to address what is in front of you and the time that you have, instead of constantly kicking it off to some distant future or even some metaphorical thing that's in your way, whether it's alcoholism or competition shooting or even how you relate and talk to your own wife. This is a chapter where I would expect to see... this is a chapter that reminds me quite a bit of some of the writing you might find in Proverbs, and I mean that as a compliment, but it also goes on to, or it kind of concludes with this thing called a sober resolution, and that he contrasts the lives of Sigmund Freud and C.S. Lewis, where both of them were immensely productive, but one of them had faced death before he died, and the other one just chose to die instead. But overall, this is it's an immensely practical chapter, particularly practical in the world of the life of the mind, and it is it highlights some of John's best arguments or argumentation in writing, which leads to chapter 5, which is the War of Ideas. This is the worst chapter in the book. It's the only chapter that I got to the end of it and I actively disliked, and I'm saying that personally, but it needs some explanation, and it's not the end of it. This is an example of writing where the author tells you what you should be reading about in philosophy and discussing ideas, but it is also the exact chapter where he should be presenting and discussing those ideas. And so instead of actually talking about ideas and engaging in the war of ideas, John is just talking about that there is a war of ideas. He is describing a history of philosophy, and he is describing telling the reader that the reader should read and discuss, when John should be discussing the ideas that he would be discussing. This is a chapter that is telling someone to go study philosophy where it should be being a philosopher. This is the only time where I'm going to kind of let go a little bit on how much on this chapter's kind of issues, but I'll be brief on it. John tells in this chapter where he should be showing. If he calls himself the Warrior Poet Society and he talks about the heart and the mind and the body, this is a chapter of the neglect of the, this is a chapter that doesn't exactly neglect the mind, but he is only arguing like that you should instead of doing it. And it's a book. I'm reading a book. If I'm reading a book on philosophy, I should be reading about philosophical ideas. This is on page 100. Everyone's got a philosophy, but some are clearly better than others. A good philosophy leads to greater understanding, and it builds more and more so we can know more and more about more and more and make better decisions. Yes. Okay. Then he talks about Mother Teresa, and he talks about the modern intellectuals are the destroyer of truth, and he talks about the millennial generation, and our parents are boomers or Gen Xers, and that while real philosophers seek to better understand what is true and live by it, anti-philosophers want to argue that there are no absolute truths and that everything is merely relative. I know that there are some people out there that are still clinging onto this bathwater of moral relativism, but it is not something that has the weight of considerable scrutiny. It is just most moral relativism is intellectual cowardice and should be identified as such. So to close off John's chapter on the War of Ideas, he closes with this. To be a warrior poet means understanding what rights and freedoms you've received from previous generations and being willing to fight to keep them. But John, you failed to introduce what those important imperative ideas were outside of a kind of description of truth and a kind of description of values, and that people hate values. So, yes, you know, it's not Stephen Pressfield, it's not C.S. Lewis, it's not Charles Taylor, it's not, but it's there, right? It's not an argument like Jordan Peterson. So let's move on, because that is the only chapter that I actively disliked. So, without further ado, the next chapter, 6, is Every Warrior Needs a Muse. And this chapter is a heartfelt argument against the military culture that John and I grew up with, or John grew up in, where divorce was regular and the joys and struggles of love were replaced with deployments. Now, this is a chapter for people not married, married, have been married for a long time, anywhere where you're at in that one. He presents a challenge to all of the stages, and for those who have been, well, except for those who have been married maybe way longer than he has, but let's not digress. And John is presenting a challenge to all of these different people on living a fulfilling marriage and pursuing your wife in a fulfilling way. He provided helpful advice for both my wife and I as we struggle through the challenges that Starting Redacted has brought upon. And there's a lot of marriage advice in the way that someone might look to an older brother or a friend or somebody who has a little bit of humor and a whole lot of compassion built into it. This chapter is not a substitution for marriage counseling, but it is an excellent chapter that you shouldn't skip. You got it all just because you're married. I will return again to what this chapter is. It is a heartfelt argument against the idea that we can disdain love and replace it with the urgency of a deployment, a job, or whatever, and rather that men should not seek for permission in other people, but should not necessarily seek for permission, but pursue love with boldness. I think that's an odd one. I think he paints it so well in the framing of love as love, especially in relationships, as not something that you kind of fall into and that beats you over the head in some sort of poorly written sitcom, but rather is something that a person pursues intentionally day in and day out, with the highs and lows and the pains and sorrows. And for a man who he's been married for 17 years at the time of writing, he presents some useful and encouraging components for pursuing love, pursuing love in relationships. And so that's kind of the awkward one. Now, the next chapter is titled Learn to Dance, and this chapter comes in two halves. The first half is a completion of chapter 3, which is Battle the Inner Coward, where John presents courage in a way that is not battle-centric. Now, it's not tropey, although you could probably argue it that way. I wouldn't really take it in that well. It shouldn't be taken in that well. He talks a lot more about being balanced, which is actually a... he's making this argument that you should do things that scare you, and do things that even things that are not, say, life-threatening, like jumping out of a plane or bungee jumping or base diving or going to war, but there are other things that scare us and that we should be courageous in pursuing and solving those things. It's sort of a Christian ethic version. It's a sort of Christian ethic that just because you're afraid doesn't mean that you're permitted not to or you shouldn't do it. In fact, maybe pursuing the fear and conquering the fear through diligence and bravery, not just bravado, is good for itself. That there is a Christian ethic to the obstacle being the way forward, and this is applied in the in relationships and in love and in conversations and in family. And the second half of the chapter, though, the second half of the chapter is a preparation for what is to follow. He puts a heavy emphasis on balance, and he puts a heavy emphasis on identifying balance in all areas of life, not just simply balancing the warrior and the poet, but the minutiae of the warrior and the poet ways in different areas, maybe work or relationships or church or community or participation. But what he's doing here, and I don't know if it's intentional actually, but if it isn't, then congratulations. Or if it is intentional, well done. And if it wasn't intentional, congratulations. I think your hard work is paying off. Because in the later parts of the chapter, he's presenting a refreshing metaphor for a subject that is easily tired with repetition, which is not that balance is the solution, but it is something to be pursued, and that it is something that it can be achieved, and it is something that we can seek after in our life with our wives and our children and our families and our jobs and our pursuits and our hobbies, and, which leads into the next chapter, our ambition. So this is the eighth chapter. The eighth chapter is called Goodness, Not Greatness. And if you're looking for heavy conviction, this is where you're going to find it. And this is the sole chapter that I have used to justify not producing a spoiler for the entire book. This is John's writing at his best, and with a second pass, there's foreshadowing throughout the book. This is a chapter about ambition, and this is a chapter about achievement and striving for greatness and pursuing all of the things that keep you up at night and drag you into the depths of hell because of regret and pain and depression. This is the chapter where John is arguing not only about ambition, but that ambition is not alone, that we cannot survive solely on ambition, but we require something else. And he's paraphrasing, in a sense, ambition with greatness, and it's greatness in achievement, greatness in the measure of a man, greatness in success. It is this argument that ambition can't just be the only goal in our lives, but will be there, and it ought be there. This is not the passive argument that you see from so many masculine writers, especially in the Christian sphere, to kill your ambition, kill your desire, kill your drive, and go be passive. If John were to holistically identify the war metaphor in the beginning of the book, this is where he would have done it. But even though it's not in these pages, this is the chapter that makes this entire book worth reading. It is not oftentimes when you read a book and you've got 250 pages of slog for 3 pages of solid gold. But those 3 pages are worth the entire book. If you've read Crime and Punishment, you know it doesn't really come till fruition, till the end. And in John's book, it is in pages 190, 100, and where does this start? Page 100 and 180, where all of the reading and listening that you've done up to this point comes together in a great sense of conviction. He talks about the morality of ambition. He talks about pursuing that which is right and true and good because it is right and true and good, and not costing the battle not losing that which you fight for the sake of the thrill of battle. This is the anti-barbarian argument, not in the Jack Donovan sense of barbarian, but the anti-barbarian in the sort of casual sense. This is rather him arguing, not only I think effectively, but I think in some pages very passionately, drawing on more than just experience, but on past wisdom to level in that it's not just greatness, it is not just goodness, it's a both and. And it's a both and in the life of men that is worthy of pursuit. Now, in the event that some of my recording was lost, I am going to reconclude with what I was talking about, the chapter of Goodness, Not Greatness. Goodness, Not Greatness is the eighth chapter in John Lovell's book, and it is one of the best chapter in the book, hands down. No questions asked. If you're looking for heavy conviction, this is where you're going. This is where John's writing is at his best. There is foreshadowing in the early chapters of the book that lead and culminate in this one. And it is a chapter about ambition and tempering ambition in this chapter. He does not... Let me reiterate in this conclusion. Let me reiterate about chapter 8. This is the tragedy where not the... John chapter in goodness, not greatness. John does not condemn ambition. Rather, he fulfills it with the pursuit of goodness. He does not condemn men for pursuing greatness, but he builds it into a complete picture. It builds into that whole man attitude where you might think that your ambition is driving you to become the whole man, to become the complete ideal, but rather ambition alone is not the solution. The ambition to greatness, to even if that greatness is the ideal of the whole man, is not sufficient. Rather, we must pursue being good. We must pursue being good and doing that which is good for the sake of goodness. And so this chapter, being John's best writing and best writing in this book so far, does it justifies its place on the shelf. It plants John Lovell firmly in that lineage of Wild at Heart and Point Man and Man of Steel and Velvet, Royal Manhood, and these other Christian books written from men to men. And this is something that really does, it just adds so much value as a philosopher in this philosophical sense with these moral imperatives and priorities and values and integration. And so if you're hesitant about reading John Lovell's book, or you've started it and you haven't gotten this far because his kind of teeter-totter between serious and silliness is wearing you out, I suggest you power through it. Read chapter 7 on Learn to Dance, and then read chapter 8 on Goodness, Not Greatness. It is the best chapter in the book by far. So chapter 9, moving on, and I'm sorry, even if that is going from a high to like kind of something more casual, chapter 9 is something that I'm really not going to comment on because I do not have children myself, but he argues for raising children well and pursuing their lives and livelihood well, and I think this is something that is very oftentimes missing, but I do not believe it is appropriate for my commentary to be presented at this time, not because of standpoint epistemology, but just because I have not a lot to say about it. But let's move on to the last chapter, which is chapter 10, How to Stay Free. This chapter is a challenging chapter to read because it's one part homesteading, it's one part conceptual isolation, sort of. It's another part of what to focus on that you can control. Like it's inspiring or instructing the reader to focus on what they have authority over and they have control over, but it doesn't provide the direction that I think it could. He allows the concept of homesteading to be painted in the picture of critics who are not willing to understand anyway. So it's a little bit in my head of like, what's the point? I'm not trying to convince somebody who wants to live on government welfare that homesteading is a good idea because they want welfare. This is the chapter where the urgency of the war of masculinity doesn't really stick very well. And I think this is where, or not I think, but it's these are all kind of negative things about the chapter immediately, where he's talking about self-sufficiency is something that like you can pursue self-sufficiency, and sometimes it's like ideological self-sufficiency, and sometimes it's moral self-sufficiency. It's never moral, but it's sometimes like think for yourself kind of stuff, and sometimes it's like grow your own food, and it's like all of these ideas. I don't want to call them trendy, but the trendy homesteading ideas are just sort of jumbled into a chapter and tied together. It's not so much of a flex, but it kind of comes across as one. But here's the good thing. This chapter should be a launching point for John's next book. It should be a launching point for the additional material that he produces. And if he fills out and fulfills this chapter in his Warrior Poet Network, that's a great thing. If he writes a second book and he completes this idea, another great thing. The amount of intellectual weight that's delivered into chapter eight on Goodness, Not Greatness is the key component of this book, not his chapter on homesteading and not his chapter on how to stay free. And that is tied into, he warns against isolation. He suggests taking care of not only physical, but the spiritual well-being of your family. He argues that there is a moral obligation that you are capable of fulfilling these things. In other words, John does a good job with this. It's not such the prepping and the homesteading world, but he says, here's a good thing that you can do, and by the way, you can do it. He's not layering on the moral obligation of becoming a homesteader to the individual and then neglecting to inform them that they're actually capable of accomplishing it too. John is a very accomplished businessman. I'm sure his bank account is not a zero bank account. I know his home is not a, it's not, he's not like living as a billionaire or nothing like this. But the one thing that John does well in this writing is he doesn't lecture people who are not as well off as himself on how to do something. What he fails to deliver on here is sort of in, is illustrated on page 150. And that is, he makes this statement, everything we love rides on our willingness to protect the liberties we take for granted and band together, because one day you're going to need this freedom far more than you imagined. What do you mean by that, John? What do you mean? I think this community, your audience, our audience, the people that I talk to, the people that you talk to, we're beyond the phrase that we're going to need it. Describe it, point the direction, lead. John, this is a chapter that identifies John as a leader, and he should lead. He does a great job of it in his business, in his community. John is an upstanding individual, so far as I have known. But he talks about the voices of modern-day tyranny may try to bury you, cancel you, or even discredit you, but the man who speaks up for what's right inspires others to do the same. John, do more of that. Do more of that. You've done it well in this book, especially on goodness, not greatness. But here is where we go into, this is how we remember we are not alone. And I like, this chapter is... lives off of the lifeblood of chapter 8. And so the conclusion and the closing argument, I think in a very important way, once you've read the book and you get to the conclusion, you might discover that the conclusion of John's book will not blow your mind. It's not the end goal or the end chapter. The conclusion is not like the magnum opus conviction aha moment, but rather the intensity and the conviction of the book rolls back and forth like the waves, chapters 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, and then by the end of 7, it launches into 8. You get your peak conviction, and then it kind of rides back down. I think I believe the chapter on children is very practical. I've listened to it. I don't have too much commentary on it right away, but then his chapter on living, how to stay free, is sort of casual. It's a casual argument for homesteading with a salting of urgency in certain assertions, like something's going to happen, or you know, you may not have these freedoms someday. And it's like, okay, you know, okay, thanks for the convincing argument, John. Rather, if you're going to call men to go to war, this is where you should have made your war cry. However, I think the intellectual weight and moral value of the book was hammered so heavily home in chapter 8 that if you were to add it to chapter 10, it might have fallen flat anyway. And so the conclusion is a classic John Lovell note of poetry and his conviction, which he does not elaborate on and is not obligated to do. The conclusion of The Warrior Poet Way comes across as John, as an author, writing to John, as a man writing to himself, telling him, reminding him of the things that he believes in the moral imperatives that are that drive his life. And with that, it's an interesting way to close a book, not because it's entirely unique, but because it carries a moral weight with it. To like tie up the entirety of my review of The Warrior Poet Way in a one-hour conversation, I approached the book with a little bit of hesitation, partly because I didn't want to be disappointed by it. I've listened to John Lovell's talk for a long time. This is kind of the personal side. I've listened to John Lovell speak for a long time. I've been able to go to some of his live presentations. I've visited him before. I've been able to talk with John on a number of occasions that are very encouraging. I've written for his company before in the past. And this was a book that I approached with a little bit of caution because I was worried about being disappointed. I was in the same way that you write, they say, like, don't meet your heroes. And the early chapters were very introductory level. Of course, you know, it's like if you've listened to John for 5 years, you likely have heard some of these things before. It doesn't mean that they're not good to be introduced again. But as chapter 7 on learning to dance was sort of tying in and closing off and preparing the reader for chapter 8, it broke me down in ways that I was not expecting to, where it challenged and validated my ambitions, and it challenged and validated my desire to do things that are important or good or great even. I want to contribute to the corpus of human literature on just war theory and how we think about violence. But at the same time, he so critically challenged me on the things that I've been neglecting, whether it's my family or my life or my faith or my decisions. I think that's a really good bit. And so as a leader, I think he's inspiring men to greatness. And I am encouraged by that. And although his chapter on philosophy is pretty rough, the remainder of the book does better philosophy in chapter 8 than he does in chapter 5. That's probably how I'll have to close it off. So if you've enjoyed this conversation about John Lovell's book, The Warrior Poet Way, if this review has added value to the book, please let me know in the comments below. If you're on YouTube, if you're on social media, or I'm sorry, if you're on, what else would you be on? If you're on Spotify, share this with your friend. If it ends up in John's lap and he calls me angrily one day, I will blame you because you, the audience, because you put me in this place. But, I am sure we can resolve that conversation at another time. And if not, pistols at dawn. Let's do it. So with that being the case, this has been Mom, Can We Have John Lovell? No, You've Got John Lovell at Home, the Redacted Culture Cast, where we talk about the philosophy of violence. And this time we're doing a review on The Warrior Poet Way by John Lovell. And if you have enjoyed this conversation, you can head over to redactedllc.com. And that's where you're going to find some of our store and some of our events that are coming up. By the time this video goes live, it will not be ready, but Monday, April 1st is April Fool's Day, but we're dropping something that is not a fool's joke. And so if I suddenly disappear or there are rumors in the news that I have self-ended myself, know that they are rumors. And so Monday's release, Monday, April 1st, 2024, we are dropping something that is not an April Fool's joke, but might be mistaken as one if you don't read the fine print. That being the case, go forth and conquer.